Now it's recording.
Now I'm recording. Okay. Please remind me next time if I'm not, if I'm missing one of the things. Okay, so let's get started then. This week's Parsha, the one that's coming up, is Vayeshev. And, no, in my opinion, this is the most dramatic story in the entire Torah, including Tanakh. It's one of the most fascinating areas. And that's the story of Joseph and the brothers, Yosef and the brothers. I mean, it's got all the elements of high drama. If you disagree with me, let me know. But the whole story of, it includes the subjects like, mainly like sibling rivalry. This is taken to an extreme. And
what about when they come back to Egypt and don't know it's him, and then they're at the table together, and then they, you know, he reveals himself. I think that's like one of the most dramatic moments, and he's crying, and everyone.
No, that's exactly. I'm sorry for interrupting. That's exactly what I mean. That's what it, I meant. The whole story.
The whole story. Oh, I thought you meant like just this parsha.
No, not just this parsha. Because this takes up the rest of the book of Bereishis till the end. It doesn't stop. Even after Yaakov dies and they bury him, and then the brothers come back, that Yaakov left this message, you know, before he died, he left a message, like message from the grave. Now, every aspect of it is fascinating. I don't know if there's been, I know that they made Broadway plays out of it. I think it was called Joseph and the Multicolored...
Technicolor coat.
Yeah, right. I don't know if I didn't go to see it, but I don't know if there's any movies or good movies. But it's got all the drama: parental favoritism, murder, attempted murder. Then you have the whole story of Joseph rising from, you know, from nowhere, from out of the ashes, so to speak, to become the ruler of Egypt. Like who could have predicted a thing like that? But ultimately, I think you're right. It reaches the highest point when there's the they're brought together, when the brothers come down to Egypt in search of food, and guess who's waiting for them, and what happens, and so on and so forth. So let's get started on it. I don't think it's there just for the drama. I think there's very, very profound ideas because it's Torah. So when we study Torah, look, you can enjoy the action. I think, I'll tell you the truth. When I was in, I went to yeshiva. I think it was the third grade. And, you know, most of the rabbis, that's the rabbis that we had teaching the Jewish part, were these old guys from Europe. And, you know, they were tough and strict. You know, in those days, they could hit the student, get hit. And it wasn't interesting at all. But we had, in the third grade, we had this rebbe who was the kindest, sweetest guy. And he had a knack for storytelling. So every Friday, he would tell over the stories from the Torah. And I was just caught up with it. He told it like a story, like, you know, making it fascinating and interesting. So, of course, you were learning the Chumash, but it was entertainment. And I remember I got caught up in the whole story of Yosef and the brothers. I just looked forward to Friday when he would, you know, that hour. And I was so caught up in it that I remember the first time, because I'm hearing it for the first time. Now, once you know the story, okay, it's not a surprise anymore. But I was so pained by it. I took it so personally. And when the brothers come down, the brothers are coming down. Yosef is there. They're going to be reunited. You know, it's going to work out happily ever after. And then when Yosef acts strange to them, he mistreats them. Oh, was I hurt? Like, what is going on? Why is he doing that? And so on and so forth. I remember in the that scene that you talked about, when he makes himself known to his brothers, I like burst out crying. I still remember. As a little kid in the third grade. But since that time, you know, as a Rebbe and a teacher, that story has always been, I mean, I have many classes on it that have been taped and written stuff on it. It always grips me. Okay, but I'll try and control myself. I'll try not to cry this time. I don't think we'll do it all. I don't think we'll do it all in one session. We'll probably have to devote a few sessions because I don't want to run through it. But let's begin at the beginning then with Parshas Vayeshev. And at the beginning of the parsha, if you have a chumash, follow me. If not, you know, it won't be that complicated. We're in chapter 37 of Bereishis. And at the very outset, first it tells you these are the descendants of Yaakov. And it goes right to Yosef. Yosef was 17 years old, and he was the shepherd. He shepherded or he pastured the sheep with his brothers. And he was a youth. And he hung out, so to speak, with the children of Bilhah and the children of Zilpah. Now, if you remember, Bilhah was the handmaiden of Rachel that Laban had given to her when she got married to Yaakov. And Zilpah was the handmaiden of Leah that Laban had given his daughter when she got married. Well, they got married within a week of each other to the same husband. And so now it's telling you that Yosef would hang out with the sons of the handmaiden. Of course, the question is, what's the significance of that? And then it says that Yosef brought their bad speech, so to speak. He brought bad reports. That's a better word. I guess we would call it snitching. That's what it sounds like at first glance. He would bring back bad reports about, I guess, his brothers to his father. Okay, that's the first aspect, the first thing you need to know. In other words, at the outset of this parsha, the Torah is introducing us to the main characters in the drama that is to follow, that's going to unfold before our eyes. Who are the three main characters? Now, by a character, it doesn't have to be one person. But the players, so to speak, can be broken up into three distinct units. Who would you say they are? Who are the three main units or characters in the story?
Joseph.
That's one.
His brothers and Yaakov.
Two. And Yaakov, very good. Everything that happens is a result of the interaction between these three players. So who are we being introduced to first? Joseph. Now, what's it telling us about Joseph? Let's analyze. You see how in just one sentence, the Torah communicates so many ideas. Okay, so first it tells us that he was 17 years old when the story unfolds that we're going to be reading about. And he pastured, that means he was a shepherd, with his brothers. Now, then it says something strange. Vahunar, nar means a youth, and he was a youth. Now, of course, at this point, you got to ask a question. What's the question that you got to ask?
Is 17 considered youth?
Well, yeah. In other words, I would say it's a redundancy. The Torah doesn't waste words. 17 is young. I would refer to a 17-year-old as a youth. Okay. I wouldn't refer to a 17-year-old as a mature adult because generally he's a youth. So why does the Torah have to repeat it? If it tells me he's 17, what does it add by telling me that he's a nar, that he's a youth? He's a young, or a youngster. Want to put it, he was 17 years old. And he was a youngster. Like we may talk that way. If, you know, someone's telling you about someone, he may say he's a 17-year-old youngster, but he doesn't have to say youngster because I know that's a 17-year-old. So the question is, what is the Chumash trying to tell us? Then it mentions that he hung out with the children, with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. Okay. I'm not so sure why I need to know that. But what's the next thing is very troubling. It says that he brought back bad reports to his father. Anybody want to make a comment at this point? We're getting a profile of Yosef. It's not all that positive. It's not all that positive, it would seem. Right?
He was immature.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, very good. That would explain that term, nar. Because it's true that a 17-year-old is a youth, but you have different kinds of 17-year-olds. Some are pretty mature. and some are immature. You know, like people could be immature even in their 20s. But it's making that point that he was young. So maybe that's not such a bad thing, because a lot of things could be excused because of youthfulness. Okay? I mean, every one of us, if we had to give an accounting of what we did in our teenage years, I don't know. There might be things we would want to keep out of the report, right? Because I'm pretty sure that every one of us has done crazy things in their lifetime. Would you say that you've done crazy things in your lifetime? Huh? You know, it's okay. You can admit it. I'll admit first I've done crazy things. Right?
Yes. It's stupid things.
Stupid things. Oh, okay. Stupid, crazy, wild.
Yeah.
What was I thinking kind of things? But that's part of life. The question is, do you think that your ultimate character should be determined by those few crazy things you did or stupid things you did?
No.
You wouldn't do them now, I don't think. Oh. Maybe some of them. You wouldn't do them now because you've achieved a certain maturity. But you need a little space, because if somebody were to come out against you for something, let's say you went for a job interview and you did fantastic and they loved you, then somebody reported to them some crazy thing you did as a teenager. And then they were saying, well, we just found out you did such and such, and we can't hire you. So what would you say? What would you basically say?
You know, I'm not that person anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. That's not me. That was a crazy kid.
Right.
You know? And I was a kid. I was crazy. I didn't think about the consequences, so on and so forth, you know? Now, I think any decent person would agree that you outgrew that kind of thing. So that's what you have to bear in mind. When you studying the deeds, the Torah is warning us or cautioning us, as we study the deeds of Yosef. Remember, he's 17 years old at this point in time, but that's not the ultimate Yosef. It's a very, very important message on so many levels, in terms of how we deal with people, we raise kids, you know, teenagers, and, you know, parents go crazy sometimes. I'm not saying that, you know, there are certain things that can't be accepted, obviously. Can't say, well, you know, he just murdered five people, but he's a teenager. He'll get, you know, you can't, I don't mean stuff like that, but there's a lot of crazy pranks and so on and so forth, which can be attributed, which don't indicate the ultimate person. To the contrary, a lot of the great people in history did have these kinds of wild dispositions. They weren't the most ordinary, well-behaved, generally speaking, you know, the ones that are always, well-behaved and orderly and so on and so forth, never get into trouble. Okay, that's nice, but they don't become the great people in society. They don't have that spirit of defiance. Now, all of those things, that spirit, the independence, and so forth, that has to be channeled. These people can be extremely creative if their energies are channeled in the right direction. Okay, just making that point. So then it tells us that he was a shepherd with his brothers. What is it? Why? What is it telling us? What is it telling us over here about the fact that he would hang out? I'm using that expression with the children of the handmaidens. Let's take a look at Rashi. By the way, let's do with Rashi on Vahunar that he was a youth. Rashi says he did the actions of childishness. It's a bit critical. It's being critical of him that he was like a child or childish types of things. Like he was concerned about his hair. He would always like be fixing his hair and his eyes. He's extremely concerned about his appearance. He happened to be extremely good looking. That is, so he should look handsome. Okay, so that's another factor. So you see a certain element of vanity. He had an element of vanity. Apparently he was good looking, but not just that, but that mattered to him. And that's what Rashi is saying, the interpretation of Na'ar. Because that's like a I guess, youthfulness, immature, and so forth. Okay, then it says that he, Rashi again, on the children of Bilha, and so forth. That is to say, Rashi says, he was habitually, he would be with them. That's the ones who he gravitated to. Now, Rashi says something very significant, because the brothers would sort of degrade them or disparage them. And he brought them close. So that's important. Because otherwise, what do I need to know who he hung out with? But now, so you see at the same time, what do you see over here? You see what kind of a character is beginning to emerge at this stage about Yosef? Is it that simplistic? Is it a one-sided individual?
No, very complicated.
Yeah, complicated, because alongside of the youthfulness, alongside of the vanity, what do we see over here with regard to the children of the handmaidens? I think you see a certain sensitivity. He was concerned about them. It bothered him. And then it mentions, see, that's why it says that he was with the brothers. He had his chores. He had his responsibilities to do a certain amount of the shepherding. But at the same time, he didn't gravitate that much to the brothers of the wives, you know, the sons of the wives. But he noticed that they kind of put down the other ones, because I guess, I mean, you do see certain elements, I guess, of prejudice. See, what's also very, very important, though, we have to be very careful when we take up the story, because we're going to encounter, these are the building blocks of the Jewish people. The 12 sons of Yaakov became the heads of the 12 tribes. So they are regarded as great, great people. But nevertheless, we're going to encounter them doing things that don't seem that great. Now, we have to remember a few things over here, that the failings, the faults of these people, they're all human beings. The Torah does not have saints. The Torah does not have angels. Every one of the great people that we read about, Yosef included, is a human being. So we're going to find out about their flaws. And some of them are significant. So first of all, we have to try and put it in a context and understand it better. Because they're not base individuals that do crazy things, that just decide one day we're going to kill our brother. I mean, that itself is one of the most perplexing aspects of it. Okay, they were jealous, so on and so forth. But what motivates, I mean, you don't hardly ever read about something like that. Even brothers from the most lowly elements of society, they may dislike each other, hate each other. They don't just go killing each other because of jealousy. That's an extreme kind of a thing. So on the surface of it, it's very challenging, because we're going to have to try and explain the nature of that jealousy. Okay, so Yaakov showed favoritism, and he brought back bad reports. Is there anything in this entire account of the upbringing of the events that would warrant murder? And they didn't murder. At the last minute, they changed their mind. Yehuda changed their mind. So they were, you know, they were kind. Instead of murdering him, they sold him as a slave. I mean, how do we account for something like that? That's going to be one of the challenges that we have. And it's very delicate over here, because we're going to have to sort of understand the flaws. At the same time, they're not to be condemned. These are all, you have to have that in the back of your mind. We're not talking about low-level people. We're talking about extremely high-level people. I would call them all idealists. And what's the ultimate theme of this whole story, if we had to give it a title? It's a story of greatness, in my opinion. It's a story, it reaches a level of greatness. We wish we had that level today. Because in spite of all this, the family which was torn apart, but ultimately there was a reconciliation. So that's why at the end of everything, at the end of the day, so to speak, there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of inspiration in the story. But we're going to have to go through the unsavory parts, because we want to understand everything and how it fits together. Okay, so let's proceed now. As we said, Yosef is a complicated character. Why did he bring back the bad reports? What about that? I mean, we don't like to hear about that. Nobody likes a snitcher. Nah, we don't just kill a guy because he's a snitcher, but that's so looked down upon. How do you fit that in? Bear in mind, Yosef is one of the greatest people of our history. And look at the great deeds. Even when he's torturing the brother, so to speak, he's got a purpose in mind. He's not doing it. How do I know that Yosef is not accusing the brothers and putting them through the ringer, that he's not doing it for personal revenge? How do I know that? Any fact that jumps out at you? Well, if you go through the story, and by the way, that would be a great idea, you know, to read, to start reading the portions, the rest of the portions in Bereishis all take up this story, just to review the whole story so you have all the facts at hand. Because when he does that, he breaks away momentarily and he cries. He accuses them of being spies and he's going to separate. First, he's going to lock them all up. In fact, he does lock them all up. And then he comes up with the idea of just locking up Shimon and let them go home and bring food. He's mixing it up between toughness and compassion. But when he accuses the brothers and when he hears them, their response, he turns away and he cries. They couldn't see him crying. But if he was doing this for personal revenge, of course he wouldn't cry. Yosef was an extremely sensitive, emotional person. We see a number of occasions where he cries. And finally, when there's that, when there's the reconciliation, everybody cries. But in my opinion, all the things that Yosef did to his brothers prior to the time when he reveals himself was done contrary to his emotional desire. In my opinion, he wanted to reunite with them, but he had no choice. He had to go through the steps that he went through because of an important reason. We'll get to it later. I don't want to give everything away at this stage of the game.
So, quick question.
Sure. So
the reason why he brought the evil reports to them, to his father, I don't understand. I mean, we know that in general he loves his brothers. He wants everyone to be together. We see that later in the book. But now he's 17. He just kind of seems like an annoying, stuck-up big brother or little brother.
Right. So then the question is, what's the justification for bringing the bad reports, which would be a serious thing, as you all know, lashon hara, evil speech, slander, whatever the case may be, is a very serious violation of the Torah. So let me share with you an interpretation that I heard from Rabbi Chait about this. And it helps us to gain, it's another piece in the psychological picture profile of Yosef. See, there's two possible reasons why a teenager may be bringing back bad reports. One is just base. See, you might say, oh, he wants his father to love him more. But that's very base. That's beneath Yosef, even when he was 17. See, but there's another possible reason. Because you see that Yosef was unusual. And he soon begins to have dreams. The dreams get him into big trouble. But don't you see the emergence of a certain individual who has that tendency, that drive to be the leader? I mean, that's what the dreams indicate. That's what the brothers resented. But Yosef is someone, see, there's, you will encounter in your life, probably, you know, in school, and even in elementary, and high school, and even in college, you'll see there are certain people that gravitate towards leadership. You know, they want to be the president of the student organization. They want this, that. They want to be in politics. They want to be in charge. And then, you know, they could be probably, you know, when they're younger, idealistic. They think that they have this insight. They have the ability to lead people. Okay. Some of them do and some of them don't. Just because you have that feeling that you're destined to be a leader doesn't mean that you have the qualifications. There's a lot of ego in it. But Yosef had that capacity. He had the actual capacity, as we see, ultimately. But in youth, he had a certain sense. And a lot of these people, they are idealists, and they can't tolerate weaknesses, a certain lack of a tolerance for weaknesses. So therefore, he held that the things that the brothers weren't doing properly, whether it was in terms of how they were taking care of the sheep, or whether it was in terms of how they were treating the brothers, he held that it was wrong. And he didn't bring it to Yaakov to put them down out of pettiness, but he held that something needs to be done about it, because he was the one who had the responsibility. He had the capacity for leadership. See, now that puts everything in a different light. Doesn't mean it was right to do it. It doesn't mean it was right to do it. And in point of fact, it only got him into trouble, because we could see the rift developing between him and his brothers. So he did not have, so what he lacked was that political sensitivity to the effects of your actions on others. That apparently didn't have. But I'm sure we've all known people like that. You know? Yeah, there's always a person in, let's say, in the shul. You know? If you say a few words, they shush you. No talking, they get upset. You know, everything has to be done perfectly. Oh, it is wrong to talk in shul, but there's a way of dealing with it. You know, without the getting everybody upset. And people get annoyed. Like, you know, who appointed you to be the guardian over here? I mean, if the rabbi says a few words, okay, you can accept it. That's his job. He's the rabbi. Even then, he's got to do it with tact. So that puts things in a different light. That is basically the profile of Yosef, the key features that we need to know. He was young, and a lot of things can be distorted because of youthfulness. Youthfulness. And he was vain. And he had a certain natural sense. Maybe you want the word superiority would not be out of order. Superiority, moral superiority. And he held that people should live according to a high standard. And as a result, but he didn't have that political finesse. And you could see the same thing. That, let's take rabbis, for example. When they first start out, generally speaking, they're very idealistic. And they're going to change the world. And they're going to make all the improvements. And you'll also see that they go about it not in such a diplomatic way. Because, look, I'm doing the right thing. You know, we can't tolerate this kind of thing, and so on and so forth. But the same rabbi, if he survives the initial years and stays in the rabbinate, 10 years, 15 years later, you'll see he's acting in a different way. Doesn't mean he's not an idealist anymore, but he goes about it in a more politically intelligent way. He's learned that there are other ways to get your points across and so on and so forth. So, okay, I think there's a certain aptness in the comparison. All right, so we're going to move on from Yosef now, but unless somebody has a question or a comment to add to the profile. We're trying to develop profiles. Okay, if that's the case, let's proceed now. The next verse is Pasuk Gimel, that's 3. So we're in chapter 37, verse 3. And Yisrael, that's Israel, that's Yaakov, loved Yosef more than all of his children, because he was the child of old age, and he made for him this coat of many colors. Oh my goodness. Wow, what do you think of that?
Well, it's exactly what his mother did to him.
What?
And his brother, like playing favorites.
Okay, he played favorites. So let me ask you a question, which I ask all my audiences when I take this part. He was wrong, okay. But was he wrong because of what he did, or was it wrong? Is it wrong for a parent to have a favorite altogether? May a parent have a favorite? Now, I don't know if there's any parents out there. I assume you're all, what?
I don't think they're, I think, you know, you shouldn't tell your kids which one is the favorite, right?
So do you have to love, that's my question. Are you obligated to love all of your children equally? Or No, you don't have to. You could have a favorite if you want.
I'm a parent of one, so
oh, yeah?
I can't
okay.
really yeah. answer your question because I don't have more than one yet. But I cannot imagine, like, if I loved one more than the other, like, I don't, well, I wouldn't be able to live with myself. I might, you might love them differently,
right.
or different ways, like, but not more or less.
Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in? This is a, when I, you know, when I pose this question, it's a pretty challenging one. I would say that most of the answers are that you have to love all your children equally. Yeah, it's true, maybe not
perfectly.
In the same way. But you see, there's two aspects of love. Let me make it even clearer. In terms of the love, which means the dedication, the commitment that you have, the absolute commitment to the child, that I think has got to be the same for every child. That is, for one child, you're going to get him the best education and so on and so forth. And for another, it'll be inferior to that because you don't love them so much. No, that I say is wrong. Insofar as by love we mean the manner in which you treat the child, then every child has to be equally loved. That I agree. But isn't there another aspect? Purely the emotional joy. The desire to be together with him or her, whatever, and so on and so forth. Playing, do you like this child as much as you like the other child? So what would you say to that? Well, I'll give you feel guilty about it, which is fine. I understand. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would feel guilty about that.
Okay, that's interesting. Exactly. If a parent finds themselves, they're honest. You know, they're saying most parents are going to deny it. And they're going to say, no, I love all my children equally. The reason they're going to deny it is because they know they'll feel guilty. But let's say there's a honest parent out there. And the would say, look, you know, I can't help it. This one is amazing. This one I love. The other one I don't dislike, I love. And nothing to compare. This one's got the personality, the intelligence, and it's just a joy. The other one I have some problems with, and it's just not the same. If I'm going to be honest, I can't say that I love or like this one as much as the other one. Should that parent feel guilty? Well, I'll give you my opinion. If that should happen to any one of you, I wouldn't be alarmed. I mean, I hope all your children are good. I hope they're all good and they're all a source of joy. But some of them you might really, you know, this one is like a dream. Whatever, you know, they're successful and they're popular, you know, he or she's a great singer and gives you such joy. And the other one, you know, all right, but, you know, you have a lot of problems with them too. It may be the case and you're going to feel that emotion. I'm telling you not to feel guilty. What is there to feel guilty about? You haven't done anything wrong. There's no law in the Torah that says you must like and enjoy all your children equally. Well, just because this person is your child, does that make them likable? There's a lot of bad people in the world. Okay? All of the great Hitler and Stalin said they were all children. I don't know if their parents, you know, would have to be obligated to love them just because you're my child. No, I don't think so. I'm using that as an example. It's extreme, but I don't mean to say I'm sorry?
It's a good example. I remember seeing a documentary about Stalin, who was like evil, and he had a great relationship with his mother.
That's correct. That's correct. But again, if I was the or if anyone should be the parent, it shouldn't happen to anyone, obviously. I hope you all have wonderful children. But theoretically now, if someone's the parent, there are parents of these people, you know, of these murderous people. All of the Nazi killers had parents. So if you should be a parent of someone like that, you're supposed to love this? You hate evil. You'd regret the fact that you're the cause of this. It's your child. I don't know if it's your fault, so I don't know if, because it could happen, despite your best efforts. But I don't believe now getting to a more, you know, normal situation, there's different kinds of children. Some of them are more of a joy than others. That doesn't allow you to take away from the child. Your obligations are the same. The first kind of love, which implies the commitment, it's got to be the same. But your personal emotion of joy from a child of yours, that's going to vary. Maybe not. Maybe all your children will be great in their own ways and everyone will be a joy. Lots of luck. Maybe it will happen. But if it doesn't happen, I don't believe that you need to feel guilty, because that's normal. That's how you respond to people. But what was the crime, so to speak? What was the mistake of Yaakov? See, take a look at the verse very carefully. It says
he made it apparent to everyone.
Yeah, that is extremely important. It's the first part says that he loved Yosef more than his children because he was a son of old age. And he made for him that coat. Okay, that's the part which making the coat, demonstrating it, demonstrating your preference. That's the mistake. So if you have the ability to keep it hidden, to have a favorite, I would advise most people not to have the favorite because I don't think they have the ability to keep it hidden. So that's a factor. It's very hard to keep your true feelings hidden. And generally, if you do have a favorite, the other children will notice it. Just like students. See, but you're subjecting, you have to realize also that that is one of the most painful emotions that a person can be subjected to. And that is what they would perceive then as rejection, not being the favorite. To be in a situation like that, like you have, I don't know if anybody was in that situation. If you want to share that with us. I just want confirmation that it's a very painful feeling. That is that someone else is the favorite and you're not. It's better that there's no favorite. You see that in students in a class also, teacher's pet. Teachers have to be very careful about that. And they may think that they are careful about it, but students are very sharp about picking up on that. So for most people, unless you're really adept at covering your feelings and not letting it show, then you shouldn't have a favorite in the first place. But if you do, then the real problem, the crime, so to speak, is in demonstrating it. That's what Yaakov did. Before we move on, we have to try to understand that better, because we're talking about Yaakov was a great prophet. He was extremely like a genius individual. Everybody knows that this is wrong. The rabbis say, you see from this that you can't differentiate among your children. Yeah, but how could someone like Yaakov not know that? Also, what it says he loved them because he was a child of old age. So what does that mean? Well, why does that automatically make you the favorite? He wasn't the last child. The child of old age was Benjamin, who plays a very prominent role in the story also. When Yosef makes the demand that Benjamin has to come down to Egypt. But what does that mean he was the child of old age? That seems like a very superficial reason to love someone.
He was like a miracle?
Yeah, I'm sorry, what? I'm sorry,
go ahead. He was like a miracle?
Why was he a miracle? Because Rachel gave birth to him?
Well, yes, but also being of old age. Obviously it's harder to have kids when you're older. So.
That's true, but Rachel was young. She was young. But you might be correct in the sense that it was a bit of a miracle there. You're making a good point, because we know that she was infertile, Rachel was. She couldn't have children, at least at the outset. In fact, she finally poured out her heart to Yaakov, right? Give me children or else I'll die or I'm dead, something like that. And he rebuked her for talking that way. So therefore, you know, she did what she had to do. she gave her handmaiden to Yaakov. She did many things. She prayed to God, and God enabled her to have children. So in that sense, it's miraculous. In that sense, it's miraculous. So that's a good point. But the verse is not saying that. The verse is saying because it was a child of old age. Or you want to say that it's a miracle. But you see, if you take a look at Rashi, the term in Hebrew is akunim. So it's multifaceted. Yes, born when he was old. So I guess at the point in life, like you're saying, he didn't expect to have children. So in that sense, it's kind of miraculous when you have something at a certain point in your life when you don't expect to have it anymore. And then Rashi, see the words akunim, is connected to the word, the term of that's the term that's used for someone who's wise. So the second reason is that he was the wise son. Everything that he learned, everything that all the advanced learning that Yaakov acquired in the yeshiva of Shem and Aver, he transmitted to him. And yet another element is that his facial, he looked like Yaakov. He looked like Yaakov. So you have three factors over here. See, something like this is multi-determined, generally speaking. It's not just one simple thing. But his attachment to Yosef was deeply rooted. One, when he was born, the time in his life that he was born. But the most important of the three, I would say, what would you say? Because Rashi gave us three factors. What would you say is the most important of the three? Old age, wisdom, looks.
I think wisdom.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I would agree with you 100%. Because other things are more superficial. The thing that binds you together, the thing that creates an attachment, is sharing ideas. Sharing ideas. And if you have, because that's profound. You, in a subject, of course, that you're both involved in, you're both interested, you study together, you work it through together, you make your discoveries together, that creates a tremendous bond. I don't know if you have anyone like that in your life, like a study partner, and you have these great learning sessions, so that's a binding element. Because you realize how vital that person is to your own identity, to your own growth in life. The most important experiences. Now, for a person like Yaakov, whose whole life was about ideas and knowledge and learning and passing on the tradition, so all of his sons were smart, were intelligent. But then you have someone who's like in a different category. That is, ideas. You see, you can't share ideas with everybody. There are certain people that you can't share ideas with them because they don't appreciate them. They don't understand them. So they're not interested. Or you could share ideas with them, but only up to a certain level. Okay? But then you find a student that's on the level, that's advanced. So now you can go into that realm. That becomes a very powerful basis of an attraction. So he was the smartest of all the sons. He was the one that Yaakov was waiting for. That's also old age. When you've waited for some, old age is not just biological age. Chronological, I'm sorry. It's also philosophical. And he found what he was waiting for. Someone who he could transmit all of the most advanced ideas of the whole system of Avraham, the whole religious system. So now, in addition, the fact that he looked like him, I would say that's more of a psychological thing. It's a psychological thing that, you know, you're attracted to people or to a son who looks like you. Because it's more, you see yourself in him. So that, again, by itself may not be enough, but in conjunction, it creates a tremendous bond. So he loved him. It's just a natural thing that he loved him. The question is, what's the point of the, well, why did he have to demonstrate? Why would he do something like that? Did Yaakov not know that there's such a thing as envy in the world? That the siblings, sibling rivalry, sibling jealousy? How do we explain that?
Well, as I mentioned before, like, his parents did it to him and his brother. So it's kind of like...
Excuse me, let me challenge you on that. It's not his parents. What we have with Yaakov's parents, Yitzchak, says that Yitzchak loved Esau. It doesn't say what, it doesn't tell us at all what he thought about Yaakov. It just says he loved Esau. And then it says, but Rivka loved Yaakov. And Rivka doted on Yaakov. It was Rivka's idea that he should dress up like Esau to get the blessings. So you can't say that both parents, even if you want to say that Yitzchak favored Esau in an obvious way, if you want to say that, but you can't say that Rivka did. At most you could say is that it was split. He certainly got the love of Rivka.
Yeah.
All right, so yeah, why? What's he like? And what's the problem? Why should that be a problem? But again, let me ask you another question. Let's assume that that's the case. But just because he was, if he was favored by both parents, but let's assume that he was, why would that give him the right? Let's assume that was a mistake. Although we don't have any evidence of that in his life. But if that was a mistake, why would he repeat the same mistake? Are we simply bound to repeat the mistakes of our parents? So, for example, let's say your parents favored you. I don't know that they did, but let's say they did. And now you have...
They did, because I was an only child.
You were the only child?
Okay, yeah, so they did favor.
Now you have to be on guard. Now you have to be on guard, because you have one child now. But let's assume you have more children. Okay? So are you bound to spoil your child because your parents spoiled you?
No, but I think there are some, I mean, I don't know if this is the answer, and I'm just saying there are certain things that, I mean, like, unfortunately, you know, when a child is beaten or abused or sees abuse with their parents, they themselves will do that to their children or to their spouse, like something are passed down. So I think because one of his parents favored him, not his father, but his mother favored him, so maybe it's kind of just like it's natural to him to favor one of his children.
Yes, but I think a thinking person, for example, let's say a child, it is true that children who were abused, sometimes they deal with it by abusing their children. But we would be critical of them because that experience can cause you to become more sensitive and to not abuse because you suffered from that. So generally when you've suffered from something and you've overcome it, so you don't want to make the same mistake. We also have this idea that we don't want to repeat the same mistakes that our parents made. Now I would imagine that Yaakov is the kind of person who is going to be thinking, he's going to be cognizant of what's right and what's wrong. Someone who has all that great Torah knowledge. And if he was favored, but he's not going to do the same thing to his children. I mean, the kind of people we're dealing with, their behavior has to be explained in terms of what, why they did it. They didn't just act without a reason. That's what I think. So that's my question. Just assuming he was favored, although I don't think he was. I mean, he was favored by his mother. I'm sorry. In that sense, you're right. The reason his mother favored him, by the way, was not because of ordinary favoritism. She respected what he was. He was a man who dwelled, he was a wholesome person without a blemish, a morally upright person who dwelled in the tents. In other words, he devoted all of his efforts to learning and perfecting himself. The reason why she did not love Esau doesn't mean she disliked Esau. It just means that she didn't love him in the sense because she was suspicious of him. She didn't think he was that perfected or she needed proof because he was a hunter. He was able to be a conqueror, but maybe a hunter of people also. She wasn't convinced that it was all for righteousness. The reason she loved Yaakov is because he was a righteous person. Had Esav been a righteous person, and that's the reason why Yitzchak loved him. Because Yitzchak thought that in spite of the fact that he's a hunter, he's a materialist and all that, but he's a righteous person. Because he deceived Yitzchak. He was very good at deceiving him. He would come to him and he would ask him all these intricate moral and ethical, you know, questions about tithing and so on and so forth. He created the impression in Yitzchak that he was a righteous person who would be doing his share, who would be using all of his material accomplishments for the sake of Torah. And he was wrong. The reason why Yaakov was loved by by Rivka is because she saw that he's a genuinely righteous person. Now, given that that's the case, I don't think that simply because he received the favoritism of his mother, that he's going to do that to his sons. I mean, you know, something is wrong. And it doesn't mention, don't forget Yosef was next to last. There's no mention of showing favoritism to other sons before Yosef is born. So that wasn't his proclivity. If his proclivity was to have a favorite simply because he had been the favorite, then it would have come up earlier. But it doesn't come up until now.
True.
Yeah. So it's hard. Clearly it was a mistake. Clearly Yaakov made a mistake, and it goes back to one of the big principles we're operating under is that even the greatest of people are just people. And virtually every person we've encountered in the Torah, that's even Moshe Rabbeinu, makes a mistake, even as something which would be considered a sin. But we have to understand it, though. It's not an ordinary common thing. It's got to be something that makes sense for people on their level. So I would say as follows. I think Yaakov clearly knew that it's not a good idea. He clearly knew that it can arouse resentment. But he genuinely held that Yosef was superior. And I think he overestimated the brothers. They were older. He overestimated their maturity. He knew that it might ruffle some feathers, but he held that they're on a high enough level that they'd be able to overcome that. And indeed, maybe that's not a bad idea for a parent to give their children certain challenges. I know today the philosophy is to smooth out the path and to remove any type of obstacle from the path of a child. But it's not such a great idea because life has obstacles. And every person is going to go through experiences which challenge him emotionally. Every person is going to go through rejection at one point or another. And jealousy at one point or another. I think everyone's been there. But a person needs to be trained to be able to deal with these emotions and indeed to overcome them. Most of the gains, the growth a person experiences when he's confronted with these negative emotions and he has to learn how to deal with them and to broaden his understanding and philosophy that he shouldn't be bothered by these things. He shouldn't be bothered by the fact that there's another person that's a favorite. The Rabbi Soloveitchik, I'm sure you've all heard Rabbi Soloveitchik. One of the greatest scholars, Talmudic Jewish scholars of the past century. And he reveals in one of his writings that when he was a little kid, I guess he'd be in elementary, in Europe, in elementary school. So he wasn't regarded as the smartest one in the class. Okay, in Jewish studies. It's hard for us to imagine that, but knowing what he was. But that could happen. There was this other kid who got all the credit. He was regarded as the most advanced, the smartest. And he says that he was very jealous. It bothered him a lot. He was very jealous. Now, he had a very close relationship. His father was also a great, great rabbi. And so was his grandfather. I mean, the whole family history. So he said his father he never said too much to him. But what he said, he expressed himself tersely and short, but they made a tremendous impact. Because he got wind of it, his father, that he was very jealous of this kid. And he said his father just called him aside one day and he says, you know, Yosef, he said it in Yiddish, you know, jealousy is a very degrading or corrupt quality. And so that's all he had to say. And he said he worked on himself, worked on his emotions and worked, and he overcame it. And he says, today I'm happy about any person's success. He uprooted that emotion from his heart. Now, so you had two choices when you have a child in that situation. You can shield him from that situation. Shield him from the situation. If you know that's going on, you could arrange, maybe get him put in a different class where he's not going to face that problem. The tendency, the natural tendency of a parent is to want to shield their child from anything which is painful. And if they could, sometimes you can't, but if they could, if they could get their child out of a situation where they don't have to deal with that issue, let's say the child wants to make a team and they can't because they're not the best, to get them put into a different group where they could make the team, that's what the parent is going to want to do. Always try to get the kid that they shouldn't have to face anything painful. But then what would have been better? Let's say his father could have done that. Would that have been better? Or no? The fact that he did not, what?
No, not better.
Not better. So you see, that puts this in an entirely different context. That Yaakov thought that the brothers are on a high level, it made pain them, but they can deal with it. And if they do deal with it, then that'll be a great gain in life. We don't think that way in today's world. Today's world is like avoidance of pain. Just for pleasure. Everything is about pleasure. But in terms of human perfection, that's what could be, as I'm saying. I don't think that the Yaakov was just overcome with emotion and he didn't care. He wasn't that kind of person. I'm sure he thought it through. But the conclusion was wrong. See, because the thing is like this. When you calculate doing something, and you know, someone, many times, you know, you're going to have to do something and they're not going to like it. Okay. I don't know, whatever it is. You got an invitation to something, to a party, to this, to that. You don't want to go. And so you try to make up some excuse. Now, you know that if you don't go, they're not going to be happy. But sometimes you say, well, I can't help it. I don't want to go. And what about the fact they won't be happy? Nah, they'll bother them a little. Sometimes you calculate in terms of the quantity. I know it'll bother them, but it's not a big deal, and they'll get over it. Now, it's very difficult sometimes to calculate the extent of somebody's emotion. That's an important thing to remember in your relationships. You may find that you're surprised. Maybe your spouse. Maybe you did something. You know, I know he doesn't like it, but what's the difference? It's not a big deal. Get over it. And then you find that he's really, really upset. That it upset him much more than you thought. Now you got a problem on your hands. See, it's always difficult to calculate. It's one thing to calculate whether the emotion is there or not. Sometimes you can be wrong about that too, but that's, you generally know the person. I know this is going to bother him. But then when you say, well, how much will it bother him? Is it worth it to upset him or her? I always, you know. So there it's more tricky. So I would venture to say that Yaakov miscalculated. He thought that the brothers would be mature enough to handle it, but this is a very painful emotion. Jealousy is a very painful emotion. And it's very difficult to care. He was clearly surprised by the extent. He never quite understood the extent. Did Yaakov ever, even after the point where he saw the brothers, dislike them? When Yosef brought the dreams and he rebuked Yosef, shall I and your mother and your brothers come and bow down before you? Now, we know that he actually considered it a possibility. We know that he did consider that Yosef might be the leader, but he said he spoke that way because he wanted to remove the hatred from the brothers. But did he ever really understand the full extent of the hatred that had developed? Well, in my opinion, and we'll end part one with this, in my opinion, neither he nor Yosef. Because why would he send Yosef out on that day? Why would he send him out to see how the brothers were doing? Did he not realize that he's putting him in tremendous danger? He's completely exposed. No one's going to protect him. He's there with the brothers. Did Yosef have any sense of how extreme the hatred was? Well, if Yosef had any extent, why would he go? Oh, because his father, because of the mitzvah of honoring your father? Then you don't have to do it if your life's in danger. If your parents tell you to do something and you know that it's a danger to your life, you don't have to obey them. So Yaakov sent them out there. He didn't want him to get killed. And Yosef went because neither one of them recognized the full extent of the hatred that was there. So that's an important aspect of the story. And to be continued. To be continued. We'll stop here for the time being. Okay, everybody?
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, great. Thank you all. We'll see you, I guess, 2 weeks from now. Take care. Be well, everybody.
Bye.
Be well.
Bye.